Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of comics that have come out this week. Kicking off December, of course, with a holiday favorite, Batman Santa Claus Silent Night number one from DC Comics, written by Jeff Parker, art by Michelle Banditti. This is a in-canon story that shows that Santa Claus was one of the mentors that Batman trained with when he went all over the world. It is a four-issue series that's rolling out over 4 weeks from DC. I got to tell you, I was very excited about the idea of this because it's such a ludicrous concept. Jeff Parker is so good with this sort of thing. And honestly, I don't think it disappointed. Michelle Banditti's art in particular, I was kind of blown away by. It feels like right in line with an Ivan Reis or one of those other top tier DC Comics artists. This is very fun. I was very happy.
I agree. It is fun. It's very strange to be like, yeah, Batman was trained by Santa. It's like, what? What do you? They, and everyone in the comic is saying it's so straight faced, and it's like, oh, Santa's here. Good. Let's fight with Santa. And so it's very funny in that way and straight faced. Many versions of this comic would make that the joke. And this comic refuses that. Mm-hmm.
It's not quite as extreme, but it reminded me a little bit of the Klaus comic that Grant Morrison did a couple of years back, where it was, again, that like very jacked up Santa Claus battle Santa, and all the mythology is very much, oh yeah, this is Old Norse mythology. We're not dealing with like ho-ho, Coca-Cola Santa Claus. This is the fighting Santa Claus. And in this book, they're fighting vampires with one tooth and teaming up with Zatanna. So there is humor in there. Don't get us wrong. Like, it's a goofy comic book, particularly Damian Wayne plays with the concept quite a bit. But I like this. The one thing that I was hoping for this issue that I didn't get, that I hope they do by the end, is I feel like the only reason for doing this concept is to explain why Batman is all over the place all the time at the same time. And that's because he trained with Santa Claus. I want to see that joke. That's all.
That's really funny. Because I want to know. So, hey, real quick, Damien asking, hey, real quick, Dad, what skills did you pick up from Old Saint Nick over here? Because they don't say. It's right. Just like, it's also just crazy. Like, there's so much like self-seriousness around Batman's training stuff. Like, Batman Begins, the movie, and all the stuff in the comics continuity. To throw this in there and keep the same tone is wild.
Let's want to talk about Thunderbolts, number one from Marvel, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, art by Geraldo Borges. This is picking up after the recent Captain America run that Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly did, where Bucky finished the Century Game as the Revolution. He has won. He has beaten the secret cabal that was running the entirety of society, the all of Earth, for an entire century, if not more. And now he is building up a team that straight up is setting up the upcoming movie from Marvel Studios. But they have a big mission here, which they have decided they're going to shut down the biggest threats to the Marvel Universe, starting with Red Skull. I will say, without getting too much into spoilers, we can get into spoilers, I guess. I was worried this was going to be a very typical, like, we're going to kill the Red Skull, and then it drags on for 6 issues, and you don't really get any.
They don't quite get him.
You don't quite get him. They got him.
They got him. They got him. Well, that's what, like, it's crazy to see a series with the heroes we like, Bucky, Winter Soldier among them, who always does like sort of shoot guns and kill people. Mm-hmm. But this is, there's some aspects that some might call straight up murder in this. That I was like, oh, wow, that's bracing. I will say I really liked, there's a reveal in the middle here that I thought of a person joining the team. Mm-hmm. That I was like, oh, that's cool. And I was like, oh, of course. I should not have been surprised by this. That is an inevitable situation in this comic. So I hope it's not so inevitability driven mm-hmm. going forward. Since there's, I do like the art. I do like the vibe of this comic. Mm-hmm. Very aggressive, though.
It is very aggressive. I agree with you on it skirting the line between hero and villain here in terms of what they're doing, though I don't think you could fault anybody for saying, hey, let's kill the Red Skull, a straight up
yeah.
Hitler stand-in, if there ever was one in comic books. I also, I will say, pairing this with Outsiders over in DC, Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly taking some big swings with what yeah. they can do in a superhero universe. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is, you know, for a book that is meant to tie into a movie, it's bending the Thunderbolts comic concept quite a bit, I feel like, into mm-hmm. something that it feels like what the movie is going to be. But they do a good job of just sort of being like, getting us on board and just sort of brushing it all into what they want it to be. They're great storytellers, and this is fun. And it is like the last page sort of tease, I thought mm-hmm. was appropriately scary. It's just, like you said, we don't want the Red Skull. We're not on the Red Skull side, but they're like, they just kill a dude who isn't the Red Skull. And I was like, oh, or he's like, a Red
yeah,
Skull?
Yeah,
like,
it's the Red Skull's continuity is so complicated because he's been resurrected yes. so many times at this point. If they're going to simplify it, and that's the point here, that's good. I will say on the note that you were saying, this is not Thunderbolts. This is Thunderbolts, Marvel Studios Thunderbolts yeah. is what they're setting up here. Thunderbolts to me is some sort of team that has a twist, like a villainous twist to yeah. it in some way, that's based on the first title, but that's something that's played out in the best runs on this series. Here, I guess, because they're killing people, they're Thunderbolts, but in a very similar way to how we talked about the Outsiders book, and it was like, I don't know why they're called Outsiders here. This is not Outsiders. Yeah. This is also
especially
not Thunderbolts.
When the Outsiders book is literally like, we're actually a different book.
Yeah,
did you see that coming? It's like, oh, okay, cool, yeah.
Yes, but this is, it's fine. It's good. They're taking some big swings with some good art. Very curious to see how this pans out.
I want to see a reverse Thunderbolts, a team of heroes that are villains.
Wait, heroes who are, I can't wrap my
masquerading as villains.
Yes, there we go. Okay, let's make it happen. Yeah, Time Traveler's Tales, number one from Dark Horse Comics, created by Carl Jacobs, written by Dave Scheidt, art by Kelly and Nicole Matthews. This is following, I guess, a time traveler that falls into different dimensions and time periods. Here they fall into a sort of animal farm situation, I guess, kind of.
Yeah, sort of.
I was very surprised about this book. I enjoyed it. I thought this was a good all-ages tale. I don't know if this is time travel so much as dimensional travel.
Well, there's a lot of things where I was like, I don't know what this book is. This felt like a story. It felt like wandering around someone's Animal Crossing island for like 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And being like, all right, problem solved. So like, I don't know. And I don't know, there's a source material web series that this is based on. So maybe you sort of have to know that to understand exactly what the stakes are of this, because this definitely felt like the first couple minutes of a video game or role-playing game where you're just sort of dropped in. It's like, oh, this in this place, there are animals. Bye. So I don't quite know. I wouldn't go into this cold if you don't know the source material.
Yeah, I did. Again, I think this is a very solid all-ages book. I think the art definitely leads into that. There's some very cheeky jokes throughout this that I thought were very fun. So this works as a story, but to your point, I'm not quite sure what the concept of the book is yet, and that's something that I want out of a number one.
Yeah.
Let's move on to, as we always do, our Titans Beast World.
Oh, we do always do this.
Yes. Section? I don't know.
Block.
Block. There we go. That's
The
the right bit of
Beast. Welcome to the
Beast
Beast
Block. Well,
Block.
Beast Block. We are going to talk about Titans Beast World Tour Metropolis number one from DC Comics, written by Nicole Maines and Steve Orlando, Dan Jurgens, Zipporah Smith, and Joshua Williamson. Art by Fico Osio, Anthony Marquez with Joe Prado and Wade Von Grawbadger and Edwin Gallman. And then there's also Titans Beast World Tour Waller Rising, number one from DC Comics, written by Chuck Brown, art by Karen Grant. I want to throw something out right at the top here. The continuity of how these books work is
Yes.
biznonkers to me because what were you going to say?
I was gonna say that was my big issue with this too, because the different stories within each issue here are like, this takes place between Titans Beast World number two, and it's like the next one is in number three, and I'm like, what? None of those books are now.
I went to the internet, if you could believe it. This is the first time I've ever gone
What?
to the
How would
internet. I
stay out of that
know, I
place?
know. And I was like, does Titans Beast World 2 come out this week? And I just didn't know about it. And it doesn't.
Does
It's,
not, yeah.
yeah. And it's not that there's necessarily spoilers. It's mostly like, why are you releasing this now? I don't understand what's happening here. I don't have a problem with the stories in both of these. I think there's some interesting ideas going on,
Yeah.
but it's such an impediment to throw something in where you're like, here's an ongoing conflict in the DC universe that's going to change everything. You don't know what's going to happen yet, but this takes place 2 issues from now.
Hey, let me throw out. I don't think you need that editor's note to reference any of these things.
No.
Like, because that's again where I'm like, it's like an unforced error to be like, just so you don't know something that is happening here. Or you just, in case you don't know, we're releasing this book early because we didn't have another Beast World book coming out this week, is what I feel like is happening here. So, like, I agree. It just was strange. So, criticisms aside, shouts to our guy Anthony Marquez, who former booth man for the Bibbo and Turtle Boy short, which was
Super fun.
very fun. Yeah.
Very fun. Loved Anthony's art in this story. The big Jimmy Olsen, kaiju style turtle Jimmy Olsen. Very fun. I know you love Bibbo, so I was very
Love
happy to
Bibbo.
see.
And this was just like classic comic story. It felt like it was drawing maybe from the little Tintin, little like just like it felt like just a great old school comic book story. And I love seeing that.
And I really like the Dreamer story as well. This is one that, similar to what we were saying earlier, I think it's kind of frustrating that it was tied to Beast World because it felt like most of it, I was like, why is this Beast World? Oh, 3/4 of the way through, Livewire shows up and she's some sort of dinosaur Livewire or something like that. But most of it is a good story of Dreamer, and Nicole Maines and Steve Lando supporting her has been a huge proponent of this character. They're positing some interesting things that I would love to see how they pan out going forward. But I don't know. It was very similar to me with the Lazarus Planet one shots, where I read them and I was like, these are good stories. What does this have to do with anything that's going on right now?
Yeah, well, and this Dreamer spun out of Lazarus Planet, famously. And I wish we could get some sort of Dreamer story in another book or something, so we could actually take a breath and focus on this character rather than have it be a very aggressively propulsive part of this larger event, which it feels like in the main Beast World story, we don't really know that these Garo spores are turning people into beasts. That hasn't been revealed yet. Except in this book, it's what's happening to everyone. So it's just a strange publishing thing to tip it in that way, right? That hasn't been revealed. That wasn't revealed in Beast
It
World
was
number
the
one.
last page. The Garo spores went into people's mouths. And I think it was just Black Adam turned into a lion Black Adam, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah. So I just mean like to have it be such a
This
driver for this, it
this needs
doesn't
to
make
be
sense.
like after issue two is when we get these issues because it's
Yeah.
too much. And to talk about the Waller Rising thing, that like I don't even know if it had to do with Beast World at all.
It didn't really, and I will say I liked the elements of this story. Like I like this character. Is it Deadeye? That
I
was
mean,
cool.
let's be straight up about this. This is basically, and I think this is totally laudable. I think this is a positive thing. This is Chuck Brown being like, "Hey, let's take all the characters of African descent or people of color in the DC universe, jam them together into a team." It's pretty cool. This is a cool mashup of characters that I'm super into. It reminded me, in a weird way, a lot of the Minor Threats miniseries that's going on now, the alternates, where you take a bunch of supposedly like B or C list characters and jab them into an alternate universe where they have to fight a battle. But like, it's also spinning off of the whole Dr. Hate thing in a very weird way, where Dr. Hate is the character, mystery character, who has attacked Garo, made him turn into a evil star character who was infecting the whole DC universe. And this issue, they're like, "Oh, he went against Amanda Waller and is doing his own thing," which feels very quick to me and very off.
Well, especially like they capture Dr. Hate. And I'm
Yeah.
just like, you set up Dr. Hate in this first issue as this like big threat, very powerful. And this, he seems like just a guy who was wearing a hat, essentially. I'm
Yeah.
like, what is this? And you get too much of his plan here, I think, to understand. You're missing too many pieces to know exactly what this means, but you get too much of what he's doing to not be spoiling other parts of this event. I don't know. That's why, like, we keep harping on the publishing of this, and that it just feels like an absolute mistake, just a weird
Yeah.
mistake in the way they've done this. But on the positive side, I think Deadeye is a super interesting character. Someone who is related to Amanda Waller can undercut her in great ways. He seems like the only character that she needs ever, just based on this issue. So, like, that's a great place. I don't understand the kingdom. Dr. Hate is teleporting people for some reason. He has to move people. This is so tied up in plot. We have no knowledge about.
Yeah.
I like the art was interesting, but
I didn't love the
these two feel
art. I felt
messy.
like the art in this, I will say, I inherently liked it, but it felt a little packed. It was hard to hold on to some of the action in particular. I think what we're saying here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but both of these issues, good issues on their own with some interesting writing and characterization throughout. But in terms of the span of the Beast World event, you had Titans Beast World number one, which felt like this big kickoff to this event, and they're immediately stumbling in week two,
Especially
which is
when
a
I thought the
bummer.
first, it's a bummer. The first Beast World issue I thought was great, interesting, emotional in good ways. So this event does seem fun. It just feels like they messed it up a little bit.
We'll see what happens. We'll obviously be continuing to follow this. Let's move on to the Century number one from Marvel, written by Jason Liu, art by Luigi Zagaria. Now, I have been a huge fan of the Century series. They've delved very heavily into mental health and various aspects of that. Every writer, artist team has taken their own take on the Century. The Century died, and the concept here is the Sentry's powers, or at least different parts of the Sentry powers, start coming back in regular people. What do you think about this, Justin?
I like this. It feels like sort of half of the concept is laid out. Just to get into it a little bit, it seems as though Sentry's powers have been on his death. They split up a little bit and found other people somehow. I would argue it feels like the Sentry and the Void's powers on the Sentry's death were split, and different people are getting mishmashes of them. So there's like some people who are evil getting powers, some people who are not so evil. I like the mix of characters here. I like the way the mystery is unfolded. I would have liked to see sort of the second issue. Maybe this should have been a double issue just to know where we're going a little bit harder. But it's a cool idea. But to your point about what the Sentry is and getting into like mental health or the dichotomy of human experience, I wish we got a little bit more of that flavor because that does feel absolutely inherent to what the century is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something, if I remember correctly, that was Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee did the first series, and they really set the tone for that for every series going forward. That's not what we're getting here. And I don't fault the team necessarily. This is a much more straightforward superhero take on the century. It feels a little bit, do you remember the, oh my gosh, the movie The One, where it was, I'm blanking on the name of the actor, but basically it's basically like a Highlander situation, but with the multiverse, where he needs to kill people and take their power, and he becomes stronger every time.
Yeah.
And
also Highlander is that.
Yeah, it's a Highlander situation with like Highlander. So that's basically what we're getting here. Like
Jet Li.
Jet Li, yes, thank you. Oh my god, I don't know why I totally blanked on him. But this feels like I was saying, a more straightforward superhero book. And what I want out of the century is something more psychologically complicated. I just don't know if we're going to get that here, but we'll see.
It potentially, it does feel like there is some interesting underlying idea. It feels like there are memories associated with how the powers are presenting. And it does feel like one of the characters is dealing with this change in their lives poorly. Mm-hmm. So I do think maybe we'll get there, but again, it just feels like we're getting half of the concept here.
We'll see. Orcs, The Gift, number one from Kaboom by Christine Larson. This is, I believe, the final series in the All Ages Orcs ongoing series. Here we are seeing the orcs teaming up with / challenging their ultimate enemy. Imagine if the hobbits had to team up with Sauron, and you kind of got the idea here. I really like the art in this book. I have a little bit of a hard time holding on to the story in Orcs. But how do you feel about it, Justin?
Yeah, it does feel a little like the narrative just is a little wobbly at times, especially when this one is hinged on, as a slight spoiler, like just psychedelia in general, in a way where I was like, and I weirdly have been, the three things that happened to me today were weirdly like, and then they took a bunch of mushrooms. So, like,
was
I don't know.
Was one of them you took a bunch of mushrooms?
Yes, that's why I'm tripping balls right now. But oh, still, still, that's why this Batman Santa Claus thing feels so right on. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Because they're like, they're the same guy. Have you ever thought about that? They're the same guy.
They both solve mysteries. That's one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And Santa's parents were killed in a weird way. Canonically, right?
No, that's why I know. You don't even tell me. Gifts. I've read all of Santa's comic books.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so getting back to it's a little bit of a sort of wobbly story, but I like the art. The characters are fun and interesting. I do wonder where it goes from here. Where it sort of ends with like, and everyone woke up the next day feeling a little hungover. Problems. And I was like, what happens next?
Yeah, I want to like this book because, again, I think the art is very charming. But again, the story, a little tough. That said, there's an interesting conflict here. I like the idea of them having to team up with the greatest enemy. And I like the big wolf at the end. So there you go.
Love a big wolf.
Love a big wolf. Subgenre number two from Dark Horse Comics, written by Matt Kidd, art by Wilfredo Torres. I feel like I was looking ahead here and I was like, hard to hold on to story. Oh, wait, I like this one though. Which I understand is a little unfair. The idea here is we've got this detective who is investigating a mystery about IP and rights in the future. He has gotten sucked back into a fairy Conan jam-up type story. We don't know exactly what's going on in classic Matt Kidd fashion, but man, I love this so much. I am so into this. Like the idea of deconstructing somebody who is essentially realizing he is the central character in an ongoing story, and what does that mean? What does that mean for the rights and who controls him? I think is really fascinating. I'm very much enjoying this series.
Well, and I like we talk often about so much. It's almost a cliche to be like, this is a story about telling stories. And we've done that, like Neil Gaiman, that has been his thing for like his whole career in some ways. And this sort of is a very modern version of that. And it's a little more tongue in cheek. It feels like that postmodern take on it, in injecting IP and the fact that so much of our genre storytelling is the same story with just a different genre laid onto it. The genres that we get sort of at play here are magic noir, hard sci-fi, adventure, and low fantasy. And that's really fun. It has meta elements to it, but it's all written with a nice wink that I think is really great. A classic Kint wink. And I think we're going to just get more of that. It feels like the humor is like sort of the high concept of all of this.
Would you say there's a little bit of a Kint hint going on here?
Yeah, Kint hint. Kint hint, you're going to enjoy this comic if you buy it.
Batman 140 from DC Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Jorge Jimenez and Mike Hawthorne. We got some big stuff going down in this issue. This is the final issue of the Mind Bomb storyline as Batman fights a war on two fronts. One front is physically, he's fighting the Joker, potentially going to kill him this time. On the mind front, he's been taken over by the Batman of Zur-En-Arr, and spoilers here, but is fighting all of the Batmans of Zur-En-Arr throughout the multiverse that he gathered as he traveled through the multiverse in previous arcs of Chip Zdarsky's book. And at the end here, we get a absolutely wild twist where, again, massive spoilers, but Batman loses his fight with the Batmans of Zur-En-Arr, specifically the Frank Miller Batman of Zur-En-Arr, and wakes up, doesn't know what happened to the Joker, and Batman of Zur-En-Arr has escaped from his body and is now in the robot body of Failsafe, the robot that Batman of Zur-En-Arr created in order to destroy Batman if he went too far. This is bizknockers, is what I would say.
Yeah, it's like really doubling down and layering down on deep Batman continuity paired with Chip Zdarsky's like new ideas that he's injecting into it. It feels like sort of Grant Morrison-esque would be the comparison, taking Grant stuff that Grant really got into and now using that to inject them into new Grant type characters here. So it's fun. It's not like a fun read. It's sort of a little bit of a lift when you're reading it, but I still like it, you know?
This sort of crystallized for me when you were saying the Grant Morrison of it all. Obviously, you're right. Like, he's the guy who really dug into the Batman of Zur-En-Arr and brought him back in his run. I think there was something in the, I want to say the 60s or 70s, that tracks. As Grant Morrison always does, brings back, like, I'm going to take this crazy thing and then make it work in modern continuity. Over the course of the time we've been doing all of these podcasts, have talked a lot about how writers will try to pick up on Grant Morrison things and utterly fail. Like, I think the best example of that is Zorn, where Zorn is one of the best twists in comic book history. And then people trying to actually make Zorn a real thing was like, no, just don't touch it.
Let Zorn go. Don't gonna go back and have Zorn be just a regular guy who's like, I'm not Magneto now.
Yeah, and, I was
like,
and there's okay. two of me and we're monks or whatever. Yeah. That just doesn't work. Chip Zdarsky doing this Batman Zur-En-Arr stuff is, I think, the first time that I've seen somebody pick up on a Grant Morrison concept and it work, honestly.
Yeah. Well, because I think what Chip does is heighten the Grant of it. Like, takes it as like, oh, yeah, let's go. Let's have all of them come here. And let's put them into like
all of this stuff. It's the sort of thing you're reading. Like, it's, we've talked a lot on our Marvel podcast or DC podcast about multiverse stuff. Here, there we have Jorge Jimenez drawing Michael Keaton, Batman of Zur-En-Arr, Frank Miller, Batman of Zur-En-Arr, Adam West, Batman of Zur-En-Arr, and every iteration animated series that you could imagine. And like, it should feel Easter egg-y, but it's not, because it's there in service of the story and what it does to Bruce Wayne. And this is one of the most successful runs I've read in my lifetime, where, and I've said this before, but where it feels like, oh no, Batman might lose. Like, he legitimately loses in this issue, and in a real way that makes sense, where I don't know that I've ever seen that before, and it's kind of
Well,
amazing.
he simultaneously is losing, but also lost. Like, he lost at the beginning of this. Like, it was Chip's first arc when Failsafe was introduced. He lost. Failsafe wrecked him, like, unabashedly. And now it's just like, oh, you think it's gonna get better? Now you're double. You have two enemies in one body. So I like that. I like all of that. And it's also where distanced from Bruce, the character. Like, we're never in his head. We just watch him get his ass kicked over and over again. So I'm curious if that's a purposeful choice, and Chip is then gonna spin it back where we get in his head and it's like, all right, now I gotta really fight my way out of this, because that's cool. And there's a backup here we should talk about too.
Yes, wait, what was the backup story? Because I'm totally blanking on it.
Vandal Savage,
Oh, that's right. Yes.
just like hanging out in Gotham, which I'm really interested in this. I like the idea of a Batman versus Vandal Savage. Vandal Savage also is living in Wayne Manor, already winning. There's a reveal at the end of this backup that puts Vandal Savage front and center, which I think could be a cool
Well, let's talk about
relationship.
this a second, because one of the things that I think works really well in the front story is Chip is starting to bring all of his arcs together. Like we were talking about, he's bringing together the Failsafe thing, the Batman Zero and R thing, the multiverse thing, where he's falling through that. And so it feels like this is building this crescendo. Meanwhile, the backup story, Vandal Savage is clearly going to end up being the commissioner of Gotham City, working with the Court of Owls. Like, they don't explicitly state that, but that's 100% what's happening here. So, like,
But hating them, he hates them.
he hates them. What are we building to here? Like, and I say that positively. Like, I love the idea of being in a place where you're taking all of these elements of Batman mythology, and I do not know where we're going. That's great.
Well, it reminds me of Chip's recent run on Daredevil, where it was just really savage. It was savage to the character, and it feels like he's sort of doing that here. And you don't get that very often. There's always a little bit of love in Batman because everyone wants to write Batman, but Chip's like, I'll kill this guy. You don't even know.
Yes. So very exciting. Great art throughout. Invincible Iron Man number 13 for Marvel, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Juan Fragare. We are continuing to follow Iron Man as he is married to Emma Frost. And here they're trying to build up their Mysterium reserves so they can fight back against Orcus. Similar to the Batman thing, I love how down Iron Man is in this series. Like, I think you've used this phrase before, but they're really, him and Emma Frost, they're so on their back legs. I love this pairing. I love them being like, how are we going to get out of this one? How are we going to fight back against Orcus? It's not time yet. And then it's going to be so satisfying when they eventually do.
This is the romance of our time. And it's not even, they're not fully like romantic. Like, they're married and there's a lot of flirting happening, but I love this. I want this to be an ongoing title where they like do some stuff, they like fight some people, they're building stuff, but then they just dance. Like, let's let these, there's a line in here where White Queen is like, I'm a sapiosexual, someone who's turned on by intellect, and I'm a sapiosexual for these two people dating.
Wait, I have a question for you. So they go off planet here to try to find some more Mysterium. They
Yes,
are
I know
so far away
exactly what
from
you're gonna
Orcus.
ask.
Why is she still wearing her wig?
Why is she? I would say the opposite. Should they get off planet and she's like, all right, let's go do this thing. She's still wearing the wig, but then she puts on her White Queen like
It's
bra and shorts. I'm like,
yes.
yo, why are you wearing that? Just wear Do one or the other.
Right, exactly. So that was a weird art direction choice, but I 100% agree with you. I am so into this relationship the entire time I'm reading this issue, which I don't think is the point, but I'm legitimately sitting there thinking in my head, like, kiss, kiss, kiss.
Yeah, 100%. Kiss. I want them. Well, and I'll tell you why I think they kept the wig on, because that's who she is now. But they put her in the skimpy outfit because she takes diamond form, and then Iron Man shoots her diamond form with a light to make this great splash page. I was like, that's why they did it. And also, this is romance. This is hot. Mm-hmm. This is them, like, they're getting to it. Yeah. And I don't know. I just love it. And then we get, like, a sort of deeper continuity button for this issue where, like, Forge and Riri meeting in space. I was like, what? Yeah, this book is wild.
I love the reminder of Forge's powers, too. Him being like, yes. I built this thing. I don't know what it is. Because I do think everybody forgets the fact that his power is to build things. It's not to be a super genius like Riri Williams. So I love Jerry Duggan bringing that up. Very fun.
Well, especially like he's such a great not Iron Man. He has the opposite power. Iron Man's like, I'll figure this out. And Forge is like, I did it. I don't know how it works. And I'm like, put these guys together. They're polar opposites.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Let's move on to another great comic book, Transformers number 3 from Image Comics by Daniel Warren Johnson. In this issue, the Autobots and Decepticons continue to fight as Earth very slowly, or very quickly actually, figures out there is a robot fight going on. I know you said this on the live show, but the entire time I was reading this comic book, and I know I should know this from a Daniel Warren Johnson book, but I was like, how is this going so hard? Like, how am I feeling so many things reading this comic book? Because I don't care about Transformers, but this is crushing me page by page.
Well, it's doing it. I think there's a nostalgia hit I'm getting because it's drawn like they're drawn like the toys, mm-hmm. and they're drawn like you're holding them in your hands. They're at their perspective is at a distance for a lot of it, and then close up. So it feels like you're playing with them, and they're just getting wrecked. They're just getting smashed up. They feel like this is such a subtle thing, but like it's drawn where you feel how like obtuse and metallic they are, mm-hmm. and how they don't fit with the human world. Like, and there's a great underlying theme there where in the last issue, Optimus Prime steps on a deer and it's like, oh no, this is sad. And like, you see the soft roundness of the deer and all the people here. And then just the hard metallic ripped up shards of all these different Transformers that are getting wrecked. And there's just an inherent visual conflict there. And the fact that through all that, Optimus is like, I'll save any one human. And the Decepticons are like, I'll smash these like anything. It's just like so much happening at once. It's like seeing a series of car accidents with actual cars.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. You know, when we talked to Daniel Warren Johnson about this book, what he said, which really resonated with me, was the idea that he would rather have a character be like, I'm going to kill you and then kill you, rather than be like, I'm going to kill you and then it takes 6 issues and then finally they make a move. That's 100% what you're getting here. We're 3 issues in. There's something that happens with one of the main human characters. I felt more for that human character reading this comic book than I have felt for any human character in any Transformers movie ever. And it's... I don't feel that nostalgia hit, to be clear. Like, I played with Transformers when I was a kid and I think they're fun, but there's something that like I've never been able to connect with them. This is the most that I've ever emotionally connected, I think, with any Transformers thing ever, and it's great.
It's so good. And if you haven't, like, if you're enjoying this comic and want to just hear Daniel Warren Johnson talk about it, and this isn't about the plug here, but like our interview with him is so good. Like, he said so many interesting things. Like,
so good. It's
worth going back and finding if you haven't listened to it.
Please do. Let's move on. Talk about Stranger Things, The Voyage number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Michael Morrissey, art by Todor Ristov. I know I was a huge fan of the first issue of this book, which is basically alien on a boat, but with one of the Demogorgons. This issue, maybe this was the first issue, but this issue, there's a character that they keep calling out named Hicks. And I was like, oh, okay, all right, you're straight up doing aliens. Like, there's no subterfuge here. That's 100% what's happening. I continue to love this. I think this is like a very fun riff on the whole Stranger Things thing that takes it away from the kids and puts it into another part of the universe. Justin, I know you were not as sold on it. What do you think about this?
I mean, I like it all right. It just feels like the characters are interesting. I like the relationships, the alien and aliens like connection, I think is cool. It just feels like it feels tangential to Stranger Things, and it feels like every issue just ends with a shot of the Demogorgon like continuing to lurk. And I'm like, I just want to slide everything together a little bit more, and maybe they're probably building to that, but like have the Demogorgon be watching them or something, or like, I don't know, like make it more about something rather than just keeping the Demogorgon as just an alien.
I will agree with you that on this issue, I thought the first issue was a little stronger in terms of setting everybody up. This is very much like the, what's the situation? Let's figure out what the situation is issue. So I'm hopeful we're going to get a little bit more of that, like, Demogorgon sneaking out, killing people in the next couple of issues. I assume this is a 4-issue series. Probably should have looked that up, but
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. But whatever it is, I love the concept of it. And I think Todor Kristoff's art is very good. It actually feels in line with the Aliens books over at Marvel, which is probably the thing that's resonating with me. So
yep.
I don't know. I just want to really encourage more Stranger Things stories that are off the main Stranger Things thing. Like, let's see more of the world. It's fun.
Well, and I thought for a second here they were going to be sailing in the underneath. And that's the wrong word for it. But
now
like,
I'm forgetting what it is.
Yeah.
Good. Not the underground. That's from Labyrinth.
Yeah, that's from
Upside Down.
In the Upside Down, and I want that to be true. Ooh, I want them to have somehow slipped into the Upside Down, but they haven't yet. And so, like, that's where I want it to use the mythology more than having just
be. I think what you want, that's a great idea. I love that idea. Maybe you want things that just, like, take more wild chances rather than just be alien on a boat, but Stranger Things.
Right. I want something that feels more germane to the mythology that we're in. So like, take me there rather than just like you're saying, like interesting characters. And then the Demogorgon is just there occasionally. I'm like, make it, give me that Stranger Things. I want the whole flavor.
Yeah. Well, why don't we move on? Talk about Birds of Prey, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Leonardo Romero. The Birds of Prey have come to Themyscira. And they are trying to free, well, they've already freed Sin, kind of, and are trying to get her away from a evil entity that wants to possess her while they're fighting Wonder Woman at the same time. The action in this book is so good. Like, maybe the best that DC is publishing right now.
I love it, and I think the art is fantastic, but you got to shout out Jordi Belair's colors are so sick in this. It's such a difference maker, and it just gives it this feel that elevates everything. Because it's a fun story, like it's a fun action. It's like pitting the birds against Wonder Woman in a way that just it does feel earned. Every character gets some moments to shine, and it's great. Which is a lot of comics have great storytelling like that, but the art, like you're saying, and the action and the colors just elevate this so hard.
A couple of things I want to shout out, and these are spoilery about the issue if you don't want to know. There is a big Barda versus Wonder Woman fight that is killer. Like the way that it's drawn and scripted out is awesome. And it's the sort of thing that like feels like almost fan servicey in a way of who would win in a fight, Big Barda or Wonder Woman? Let's find out. But it is so well done, it doesn't matter. And the other thing, I absolutely love the moment. So they all, of course, lose to the Amazons and get locked up in prison. And there's a moment where Cassandra Cain is outside in her Batgirl costume, but they're like, you were never in prison, were you? And she's like, nope. and gets the kill there. I was like, yes, that is perfect characterization on Kelly Thompson's part. Of course, Cassandra would never be caught and thrown in prison. That would not happen. So there's such a mastery and hold on these characters, including Wonder Woman in this issue. It's just overall very impressive. I love this book. The Amazing Spider-Man number 39 from Marvel, written by Zeb Wells, art by John Romita Jr. After the first strike, we are officially kicking off the Gang War storyline, where the gangs of New York are all fighting for control of the underworld. Amazing Spider-Man has put together a Amazing Spider-Man. I don't know why I said that like that.
He is Alex. He's amazing. There's no denying it.
Oh my gosh,
he's amazing. You love him.
I think he's spectacular. The
I find him to be web of
Spider. Spider-Man has put together a team to battle the gang war that, over the course of this issue, he can't control, and then they immediately break apart and go in their separate directions. So I don't know what the point of that was. That all said, this is one of my favorite issues of Spider-Man in a very long time.
Yes,
because
I agree with you. I enjoyed this.
It's very focused. It focuses on Peter Parker as Spider-Man and what's happening to him. It's not batshit insane stuff involving demons from Limbo and whatever else. It doesn't involve any mystical guys. It's just Spider-Man doing Spider-Man stuff, trying to hold together a team and failing at it, which is exactly the sort of thing that Spider-Man should be doing. Plus, you got the John Romita Jr. art, and there's very, and that's a classic. So there you go.
Agreed. It's great art. It reminds me of more classic Spider-Man storytelling. I love the She-Hulk that's in this. Mm-hmm. The She-Hulk Spidey stuff is so fun. But they're also doing a smart thing here by giving the villains a lot of great characterizations and finding ways for us to root for different villains at different times, making some of them scarier, really letting the ensemble shine here. So that's good. And I didn't expect this event to be working, and I think it's really working.
I think the thing that was working about it is, again, dialing in on Spider-Man, which has been my big issue with Zeb Wells' run for a bunch of issues now, where it feels like it's all about other characters. It's not about Peter Parker. So putting him front and center and trying to hold things together and do the classic, oh my God, there's too many things going on at the same time. What do I do? That really works. That's the core of Spider-Man, and that works really well here. Love Madam Mask as a villain, very into that, and bumping her up to the A-list status that she should be at anyway, I think is great. Like John Romita Jr.'s art in here, of course, I think he draws a She-Hulk, which I think is very fun. A lot of people don't draw her wearing clothes over her clothes, and that's how John Romita Jr. draws her, that she has a costume and all this bulk under her suit, and it's very, very fun to see her that way. So really enjoyed that. The only quibble that I have is all of New York literally seems to be on fire the entire time, which I'm like,
true.
That's a lot. I don't know if that's happening, but
okay. It's stressing you out. Cause I know we've pinpointed our area on the gang war map, and you're not happy with your boss.
My problem is I know this is a stupid thing to say out loud, but I don't know how a gang war works. My impression of a gang war is, hey, we're going to take your turf, and that there's actual business stuff involved because we have to push drugs and do crime and whatever else. But this literally seems like just a gang war where it's just
a battle.
Yes, we have taken over Brooklyn or the Upper East Side or whatever.
Well, I do think it's crazy where they're like, I was in Manhattan today, and I'm reading this book. I'm like, oh, I would have encountered of absolute battle on on Broadway between Mr. Negative and Hammerhead. For I'm like, what are these guys doing? And also, it is a little nonsense. There's definitely that, but I think especially when it feels like they leave to go fight someone, and then someone just takes their territory.
Yeah. I don't know. The only other thing that I'll say on a more positive bent, I love the focus on Beetle here. I think that's good. The Beetle-Tombstone relationship is really interesting. And I love dialing in on that. So this is the most I've enjoyed Amazing Spider-Man in a really long time. So very happy about that.
And I would say hail Bumbler, who owns my part of Brooklyn. So shouts to Bumbler, that is my gang
What are
boss.
you doing? What have you been doing for Bumbler lately?
For Bumbler, let me be honest, I actually don't know who Bumbler is. I feel like that's a villain I haven't been exposed a lot to. So looking forward to shake Bumbler's hand. And the name Bumbler sounds like he's a Kramer from
I
Seinfeld-esque
feel I'm
gang leader.
picturing Mr. Bean personally.
Yeah, there you go. Mr. B, Bumbler.
He's like the
Really good.
Mr. Bean of crime. Creepshow Holiday Special from Image Comics, written by Danielle Krauss and James Asmus, art by Jonathan Wayshack and Letizia Cannonici. This is, of course, two holiday-style tales in the classic Creepshow fashion. Creepshow, I just want to say, I don't know why this was driven home for me with this issue, but is wild to me because I expect like a Twilight Zone or Tales from the Crypt style twist, but the Creepshow twist is always like, oh, what if everybody died? And it's wild. But
What if they got murdered harder than you thought?
yes. And
Twist.
that's fine. I like the second story in particular. Always a fan of what James Asmus is doing.
Shouts
And
to James, our guy James.
Letizia Cannonici's art is so good. So I like that story in particular. But what did you think about this one?
I like both of these stories. I think the art really matched the tone of each story, and just fun, like very straight over the plate horror genre in both of them. I like that the fact that they're pairing really different tonally, they're pairing tonally different stories together in these issues, and I hope it continues. Like I want to keep reading this all year long, not just in the Halloween-ish season.
Exactly. Well, it's a holiday special, so there you go. Poison Ivy, number 17 from DC Comics, written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Luana Vecchio. Poison Ivy has been dealing with a evil spore
Spore.
infection that is slowly taking over Gotham City. She's tried to shut that down in this issue.
Different spores than Beast World. A lot of
Yes.
rival spore action.
I mean, I love this series and I love how they're expanding the cast and the mythology here. The interaction between Poison Ivy and Croc is great.
They're
Also,
friends.
as much as I miss Mauricio Takara on the art, Luana Vecchio is a great sub in for this title.
Agree.
Another great issue of this book.
Agree. I love the relationship stuff going on between Harley and the woman from HR is so fun, and I love that. And I love the confidence of the writing, where it's like, "Don't worry, we're gonna deal with that later." And then for the second half of the issue, it's just Poison Ivy like hang with Croc, dealing with Grundy, and being like, "Uh-oh, this thing keeps getting worse." It's just such a confidently well-paced story from issue one. Great read. Every issue's been great for this.
So good. Let's move on and talk about Daredevil number 4 from Marvel, written by Saladin Ahmed, art by Jermaine Peralta, subbing in for Aaron Cooter here. So Daredevil by day is a priest. By night, he's Daredevil, but in this issue, he's also by day Daredevil. And once again, he is clashing with Bullseye for the first time in his new continuity. What'd you think about this issue, Justin?
It's interesting, this new flavor of Daredevil. So much of Daredevil has been everything, I walk a dark path, everything in my life is bad. But we haven't ever seen a ton of Daredevil being like, I hate my job. And so much of this run is like Daredevil being like, I hate doing this. Being a priest is hard too. I'm too busy. It feels like there's just a more everyday bummer established on Daredevil. So I don't know, that's an interesting tone. And I talked about this earlier on. It's rare when a comic really wants us to believe in the religious underpinnings that are in the book. And this comic is doing that in a way that I'm like, I don't quite know if that's working for me.
This is not quite working for me. I mean, I don't. It's still well done. I mean, Saladin Ahmed, good writer. Jermaine Peralta, I think a very detailed artist. I prefer Aaron Cooter. Aaron Cooter is one of my favorite working artists today,
Yeah.
so I was certainly missing that a little bit. But there's a lot of stuff that happens in this issue that I was not 100% on board with. I love the dichotomy that was presented and finally crisped in with the last issue of Daredevil being essentially angel by day, devil by night. Great concept. I think that's really smart. Here, they keep going with like, no, now he's Daredevil all the time. He just doesn't want to be a priest. And I understand there's a breaking point coming there, but I feel like you just introduced the concept, play with that, set that in, really deal with that tension versus him just ignoring his priestly duties. And then, spoiler for the issue, but as of last issue, we suspected that Benny Urich was infested with some sort of demon. They solve that this issue. And that's
Yeah.
very quick. That it's the sort of thing that, like, with Daredevil, it's almost converse to a lot of other things where I want to see, similar to Batman, things just get worse and worse with him all the time. But I want to see
Yeah.
that slow simmering boil to where things explode. And they're almost working through it too quickly and ignoring things that I think should be a little more palpable in the book.
Well, I agree because I want to explore this a little bit more. Because is the idea here that, I mean, Daredevil was just in hell. So
Right.
is it then he emerged and he's a priest? He's always been Catholic. Now he's like more Catholic. Is the idea here that these demons are infesting people that are friends with Daredevil? Is it just a coincidence and his power set has maybe been influenced by his belief system, which I think is another interesting idea. Like there's potential interesting ideas on the table here, but like I said, there's a sort of a malaise over this book in general where everyone feels like it's a little bit hard to do everything. And I just want something to pop a little bit out and have a little bit of a story underpinning that gets us to real clarity on what's
And
happening.
I also feel like maybe there needs to be a connection between his day life and night life, that we're getting a little bit of that, but it feels like he's off doing these superhero type things at night as Daredevil, and it's not quite connecting back to his day life as a priest. So I don't know. I like this team. Curious to see where it goes, but it's not quite working for me yet. Let's talk about Blood Commandment number two from Image Comics by Szymon Kondransky. This is following a vampire who is just trying to raise his boy, and vampires keep coming for him. I love Szymon Kondransky's art. It's so detailed. It feels like a natural extension of the Top Cow style in a certain way.
Yeah, ooh, interesting.
Almost like Jermaine Peralta, as we were talking about in the last book. It's a little more detailed and a little more shaded there. But good stuff there. I enjoyed the second issue. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I like the art, just the detail, the style is really nice. Also, the way it goes from sort of panels, tighter paneling into like wider splash pages, I think is really nice. It feels like there's a flow to it, which is, you don't always get in a lot of different, especially comic book artists that are writing their own material. The story is interesting and dark. I don't quite, it's hard to put all the pieces together all the time. Similar to Something Epic, which Simon's other book, which we really liked, sort of went up and down a little bit, but very much that thing of like, oh, I don't quite know what's happening. Oh, I like this, what's happening. Like, oh, you lost me a little bit there. Oh, I like this again. And that, I think that's a fine narrative flow, and this book is definitely hitting that as well.
Yeah, I agree. Mostly it's some really interesting images and some very cool looking vampire fights throughout. I had a little bit of a hard time focusing on the emotional hook of this issue versus the first issue, but I don't know. I'm still into it and curious to read the third one. Shazam number six from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid, art by Dan Mora. In this issue, the Captain, which is the new name of Shazam, is fighting back against the gods that give him his powers. This is just a Goofmatron 2000 is what's going on here. There's some goofy bits throughout. I'm having a nice time.
And I think that's a good way of saying it. Like Mark Waid is just balanced. It's one of the most well-balanced comics that's coming out, where it's like superhero action, goofy gags, and then some continuity underpinnings to give it all like a frame to live in the DC universe with. So it's just great workman-like comic book that feels just like a light, fun read.
Yeah, and you've also, you've got Dan Mora's art. How could you be mad at a dinosaur dressed up as Crime Master? That's very fun. The whole thing that happens with the Shazam family is fun. I don't know if the solution to the problem with the gods completely makes sense or works, but at the same time, I had a good time reading it, and I will continue to read this book. It's just a, like you said, it feels like a really good mainstream all ages book, which we don't get a lot. And it's fun. It's goof.
It feels like all the characters are kids. Like the whole thing with the captain is that it's a kid who becomes this man superhero. But it feels like all the characters in this are also secretly kids. They all behave like kids. And that's a fun lay-on for the first Shazam.
Fantastic Four, number 14 from Marvel, written by Ryan North, art by Ivan Fiorello. The kids, speaking of kids, from the Fantastic Four are supposed to come back to reality after a year. Unfortunately, a bunch of female supervillains are doing construction on the site instead, so the Fantastic Four clashes with them. Another good, solid issue of this book that I think really dives into the stuff that Ryan North likes in particular, which is interesting science stuff, in this case, predictive algorithms and other things like that. So another smart, done-in-one concept that ends in a very sad place, to mildly spoil it.
100%. Like, as a man who continues to be tripping balls, like, it was such a harsh buzzkill at the end, but in an emotional way that I enjoyed. This book is just such a marketplace of ideas. There's so many great ideas on display in every issue of this that Ryan North is putting there. This issue continues that. I will say, I feel like the Fantastic Four were pretty harsh in there. I know he's like a villain and like doing a worldwide scheme, but they literally are just like, yeah, well, we just burned your whole business down. I was like, yo, okay. Mr. Fantastic, not fucking around for a change.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see where this is going to go after the end of this issue in particular, and what's going to happen next with the title. I also kind of love having a crest of the action in issue number 14. You usually expect it at 12 or 24 or 25 or something like that. So interested to see where it goes.
The emotional hit at the end is surprising here, but it really does hit.
Kill Your Darlings, number 3 from Image Comics, written by Ethan S. Parker and Griffin Sheridan, art by Robert Quinn. I feel like, did we read this before?
We did read this before and reviewed it,
Oh, great.
we got an advance of it, I believe.
Ah, there we go. Well, we can talk about it now. They are bringing forward a big villain for the series. It seems like we are having our main character, who has been aged up, is traveling back to the magical land of her youth, bringing her friend with her. And that friend, spoilers, gets corrupted by the ancient evil that has taken over this land. I don't think we mentioned that in our advance review, but man, I love this. I think the art is great. I think this emotional twist here by pitting the friend against her is absolutely perfect. When we interviewed this team on the live show, they talked a little bit about being inspired by Donny Cates. This feels like a very Donny Cates twist here. Great stuff.
Well, it's hard to do like the push-pull between like comedy and real emotionally driven drama, and this book just does a great job of that. It helps that the concept is sort of built around that, but they continue at every issue, and astute listeners can compare our advance review with this review and see who's bullshit and who's not.
Oh, there you go.
Real dare.
Sacrificers, it was Pete. Sacrificers number 5, it was not Pete. Written by Rick Remender, art by Max Fiumora. So This takes place in a world where we have a bunch of people who are taken to be sacrifices for the gods. It turns out the gods drink joy. They suck the joy out of children and they drink them in order to stay young. We've had this character who is the daughter of one of the main gods who has flown off and is trying to save these children and change what's going on with the gods. I said this with the last issue, like, man, Rick Remender is my Lucy with the football because every issue
Got
I'm
you.
like, oh, here we go. Hope. Oh, no. No hope. Okay. All right.
There's a lesson perhaps about Rick Remender's worldview in there that maybe you could to take to heart, but this is still amazing. I love
Oh,
this
yeah.
book. The art is really great. This is a sort of a deeper mythological issue compared to the others that our sort of main character we spend a little bit less time with, but hard introduction to the villain and great potential conflict set up and tragic things happening. So.
I every issue of this book, and I think this is honestly a wonderful place for a comic to be. I don't know where we're going next. Like, I don't know
Yeah,
what is
from
going to happen.
issue one, it's been like totally like I haven't been able to predict what's happening, but I like every issue and where it takes us.
And to your point, Max Vermore's designs of these characters are beautiful. One of the things that we get in this issue is we find out the person who juices the kids is also a bird person, like the main character that we've been following,
Yes, I think
which
that's a
feels
big.
like an important detail that we're going to find out more about. Man, this is so dark and so sad, and I love reading it. I don't know why.
You think he's gonna be like a bird uncle?
Oh, bird uncle. I love a good bird
Bunkle?
uncle.
They got a
Bunkle,
bunkle
yes.
sitch. It's a bunkle sitch.
100%. The Midnight Show number 3 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Cullen Bunn, art by Brian Hirt. Speaking of dark books, this is about a old school monster movie that has gone absolutely wild and released all the old monsters onto a small town who have proceeded to murder most of our main characters in graphic
Yeah,
ways.
you
We
see
talked,
it.
yeah, we've talked a lot about with the last issue about how shockingly hard this went with killing characters that we were all in on. That continues in this issue, and shouts out to it for doing that.
Yeah, I think this is great. I think there's a central mystery here. That we don't quite know why everything's happening, or we've been set up to think it's a certain way. I have a prediction. We have our like all the townspeople, like our young characters who are just wandering around, and they're riding with this Van Helsing character. And there's a great like sort of preamble at the beginning of this cold open that shows the conflict from the movie with Dracula fighting Van Helsing. And there's this moment where he gets knocked down and he's looking at the blood that Dracula is about to drink to become the god of monsters, the puppeteer of all the other monsters. I think the Van Helsing is the god of monsters and is taking control. If you read this issue with that in mind, it's all a farce that this guy is running to try to get to the ultimate power here. So that's what I think is happening, and we're going to get a fun great twist next issue.
I love that idea. Whatever happens, though, this is one of the best books that I think Cullen Bunn has ever written. I am having
Yeah.
such a blast reading this, and I think a lot of that is up to Brian Hirt's art that feels a little bit like Erica Henderson's art, but maybe not quite as cartoony, but very fun, very bloody, very gruesome. This is a great horror book. I'm having a blast reading this.
Cullen Bunn, you got it done.
The Avengers, number 8 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by C.F. Villa. The Avengers are under attack on two fronts, one in their dreams by Nightmare,
Been there.
who just wants some respect, you know? And the
Yeah.
other is the team from the Timeless issue that came out last year that I'm forgetting the name of. They are like, they're working for King Arthur or something. I don't know.
Yes, the Twilight Court.
There you go.
Is that what you mean?
Yep.
Yes, and King Arthur is under wraps in like some metal. And there's like some relationship stuff happening here. They remind me of the Pantheon from your classic Peter David, Incredible Hulk run many years ago.
You're a McKay head. What do you think about this, Justin?
I like it. This Avengers run, we're 8 issues in. Don't you dare. I don't know. I saw that neck tilt.
Huh.
You didn't see it, but I bet you heard it,
Okay.
listeners. There's just so much happening. We're so deep down the story in a way that I like. I like the way Thor solved some problems here, and the Vision Scarlet Witch stuff I thought was good. I'm on board.
I love the nightmare stuff. I wish it was just that because the whole Twilight Core, it's too much going on at all times in this book.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. And this is a corollary thing. I mean, this almost goes back to what we were talking about with Titan's Beast World a little bit, but there's a bit of publishing thing in terms of we had last year's issue of Timeless come out in, I want to say, December, where it teased the Twilight Court and Kang and everything that was going on. We're a year past that, and we're finally getting maybe to it a little bit. That's too much time. Like,
Well, here's
I
the thing. Anytime you go to court, it takes a while to get to
totally
your actual trial.
100%.
So.
Absolutely. That just struck me when I looked ahead to there's a new issue of Timeless. There's Timeless 2023. Number one is coming out towards the end of the month, which is a totally different story by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. And it's like, stop previewing things when you haven't finished the previous thing that you previewed. Like, I don't need
Wow.
previews. Just finish a story is, I guess, what I'm saying. And I love the idea of Nightmare. I love the idea of the Avengers being trapped in their dreams, but the Twilight Court being like, we're all standing here on different levels and threatening you is, I don't know. I don't have any connection to it. It feels very much like whatever that team was that menaced them in the first arc that I'm forgetting the name of, the Immortal City and other things.
The Impossible City, Alex? Is that
Oh,
what
I'm
you
so
mean?
sorry.
Which is now the Avengers headquarters?
Get to that. I want to see that. Like, what are they're living in a city? What does that mean? I don't know.
And I know what you're thinking, Alex. Justin, name the name of the team that was fighting the Avengers last issue. And yeah, I wish you would say it because I could easily name it.
Sure.
And
Totally.
there's
I
no
don't need
way
to prompt you. You know what it
You don't need
is.
to prompt me. I know what it
No,
is. You don't need
you're
to ask me.
absolutely aware.
And those of you watching the video know that there's different shades of light hitting my face because there are different windows being opened and closed on my laptop. But that doesn't mean I'm Googling what the Ashen Combine is, because I know what the
Ah,
Ashen
the Ashen
Combine is.
Combine. There we go. Yes, we all know that. We love the Ashen Combine. We're all big fans. Petrol
I
head.
like this. This is good. McKay for life.
This sucks. I hope you die. Petrol head number. No, it's
You
fine.
mean me?
Yeah, I mean you personally. No, this is fine. I like the art. Petrol head number two from Image Comics, written by Rob Williams. Art by Pi Par. Is that correct? Did I write that correctly?
Only time will tell.
I guess we'll
Yes,
find
pie
out.
par.
This is basically Fast and the Furious meets Real Steel as a robot takes
Oh.
a young girl and her father to safety in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. There's a little bit of Mad Max going on there as well. I love the first issue of this. The second issue also doesn't disappoint. I think the character designs are great. I think the action is propulsive. And there's a lot of emotional stuff that goes on here as well that I won't necessarily spoil, but I really like this issue.
I agree. The art's fantastic. There's a little bit of Futurama, where Petrol Head is sort of a bit of a Bender character at different
Yep.
points. There's a lot of fun happening here as well with Cockney accents. This is a nice package of different ideas with great art to showcase.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very propulsive throughout, which I appreciate it. So if you're looking for a good action book with a bunch of cheeky humor, I think this is a good one to check out. The Space Between, number two from Boom Studios, written by Karina Becko, art by Danny Luckert. I was very curious to check this one out based on our discussion of the first issue. This was a very Titanic love story of a upstairs-downstairs couple who got together and ultimately ended up changing their entire space station. We questioned why this was an ongoing series, and now we find out in the second issue. So what did you think about this one?
It feels like just a totally new story. Same space station, different characters dealing with the dangers of populism and exploiting different social strata for political gain, which I like that topic. It is strange that these issues connect, because they connect very, very vaguely. But I like both of the stories. And again, what's going to happen in the third issue? Are we just going to do new stuff again?
I don't know. It's an interesting idea. I appreciate the fact that this is a title taking chances, which is something that comic books don't do. So it's telling a overarching story of a society is kind of fascinating. I think the art is really solid throughout. There's good characterizations. It's a lot of talking, so get used to that. But it feels in line with like what Isaac Asimov's Foundation actually was.
That's a great connect. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of thing where it's like, what would a society be like? Let's follow it as it goes. So
yeah,
I appreciate that. We don't get a lot of straight sci-fi anymore. X-Men number 29 from Marvel, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Juan Cassara. In this issue, we are meeting Doom's X-Men. Basically, Dr. Doom decided as soon as Krakoa got started, nope, I'm going to start my own X-Men and have my own team. We get to see the genesis of that, as well as Wolverine and Kitty Pryde fighting against it. Man, this issue is so good. I mean, Juan Cassara's art is next level with the character designs. I think, not to contrast it with something else, but comparing it to like the Ashen Combine or the Twilight Court or anything like that, these feel like instantly iconic mutant characters that actually that I was very impressed by. The opening sequence is so much fun, where Dr. Doom calls in the middle of the Professor X's initial announcement of Krakoa, and he interrupts it with the punchline of Magneto being just like, just block him and move on.
Great. So job. Funny. So also, Doom's in like a bathrobe calling from like a funny helmet. I was like, this is crazy. This whole issue is so good. And I'm like, is this part of this event? This feels like such a time capsule from something absolutely unrelated.
Well, just to mention about that, I've gotten, this is a stupid thing to say out loud, but I've gotten very into subscribing to newsletters from people. Mm. And I've subscribed to Jerry Duggan's newsletter, and he mentioned in his newsletter, the idea of this issue was like, he had an idea for Doom's X-Men that he just could not let go. And given they're wrapping up the Krakoa era, he's like, all right, I'm just going to do that here. So this is
great.
100% that. And I love that he did that.
It reminds me a lot of what Jonathan Hickman used to do when he was doing the Avengers, doing both titles. And it would just be like, this issue is like Hawkeye and like Sunspot or some random other Avenger, and they're gonna go fly to like Russia and fight some random people and then fly back home or whatever. And it was like, oh cool, I don't know how this relates to the story you're trying to tell or whatever. And like, I like that Wolverine gets his ass handed to him in a way we don't usually see. He gets beat up and he's absolutely ineffective the entire time. It's great.
Yeah.
And then just a great, it's such a great Doctor Doom issue. I do like the idea that, Latveria has X-Men. Great. They're totally beholden to him. There's some mystery here with some of them. Mm-hmm. It ends in a place where they're like, I guess we're friends with him. Sort of.
And there's a great kickoff for, we're heading into Rise of X and Powers of X, which are going to be the end of the Krakoa era. And there's a great tease here, which is horrifying. So overall, really good issue, very fun. Last but not least, Midlife or How to Hero at 50, number three from Image Comics, written by Brian Buccellato, art by Stefano Simeone. This is following a character who has discovered that he is fireproof and also cannot control fire, but he can move fire out of his way, and he is using that to try his hand at being a sort of superhero. A lot of this issue is taken up with his friends and family dealing with that fact. I love how relatively realistic this is, and they're not letting that go. This is a very smartly written series that I'm very much enjoying.
It's one of the best just superhero origin stories where the character is good at being a hero, is a hero, but also messes up and is also not confident. It reminds me of like early Miles Morales stuff and like really establishing a hero that we don't understand what the power set is and the situation around them. There's a villain here that is like sort of intimidating, but also sort of goofy, and we're left in a place that I really like. This is one of my favorite brand new superhero series on the stands.
I think you called out Unbreakable with the first issue, and this really
Yes.
feels like not a straight up comedy, but a more comedic extension of that. It could exist 100% in the same world because you have a hero with relatively realistic power set, and I don't know, I just love how they're dealing with this. I love how he's telling his wife in this issue, and what does that mean? And what is that conversation like? He's dealing with the fact that he's like, I can go into fires, but the FBI agents say, oh, you could control fire. And he's like, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
It's nice, and giving him limits, I think, is so smart and so interesting. So really enjoying the
Yeah.
series. Also, shout out to Stefano Simeone's art, which feels cartoony, but not overly much so. Great stuff, really good. And that is
Really
it for the
fun.
stack. If you'd like to support us, support all of our podcasts, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We'd love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter as slash X, at Comic Book Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Time to eat some more mushrooms.